Welcome to Holding the Fire, Indigenous Voices on the Great Unraveling. I am your host, Dar Jamail. More than ever before, it is grossly obvious that the Western industrialized extractivist mindset is the root cause of the multiple crises besieging the planet today. In attempting to discern what to do, I have found it all too easy to slip into overwhelm, confusion, and despair. This is largely due to the fact that for those of us born into the aforementioned culture who are not indigenous, need a total reset in our perspective, perceptions, and understanding. In short, an entirely new epistemology. I couldn't think of a better person to speak with about this than Dr. Anne Polina in Australia.
What we must do is come together and stop discounting the ancient wisdom of Indigenous people, of First Nations people across the globe, because we have lived with the Anthropocene in the past, particularly in my country, and we have shaped that. So we were living always in a symbiotic relationship. So what we're saying is that Western thinking, Western thought, top-down leadership and governance, which has become toxic, must have a pause, must listen to this ancient wisdom, because this is the ancient wisdom that can teach us how to see and be in the world a different way.
Anne is the professor and chair of Indigenous knowledge at Notre Dame University there, as well as the chair of the Madawara Fitzroy River Council. Anne sees the river as a living ancestral being that works with and guides us, and the Madawara River is the being that gives her people their wisdom and identity. One of the co-authors of several of her peer-reviewed scientific papers is the Madawara River. From Anne's perspective, our ancient systems of living and caring and sharing with one another have become dominated by a global system built to generate financial wealth, and our task now is to remember that we must learn to live with other species, not dominate them. To feel the consciousness of the place on the planet where we live, and that we have a responsibility to love and care and protect the part of the planet where we live, to hear and speak to and feel the vibrations of the earth. Our conversation ranged from these topics to dreaming as a research methodology that includes hearing and feeling ancient landscapes, to understanding that we live in a pluriverse and not a universe, and that now is the time we must collectively begin dreaming for the future we need. I trust you will find this conversation as engaging and mind and heart opening as I did. Hold that spirit close. And thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I'm really grateful that we can connect and privilege my voice with other voices who are standing up to protect our beautiful planet.
Well, I'm going to jump right into it with you. And I want to start with asking you to please explain the Madawara Fitzroy River Council to our listeners. What is it and how does it function and how does it serve?
Thank you for the opportunity to share what is the Madawara Fitzroy River Council. The Madawara Fitzroy River Council is made up of very senior elders from the top of the catchment to the bottom of the catchment. There's about six different nations that are represented. And what's really unique about our council is what we call a bottom-up governance approach. So it's elders who've lived in the world, seen the world, being a very big part of it, but really wanting to take a different role in terms of providing their wisdom and their guidance to how the council is to respond, particularly to not just unjust development, but building the capacity of our young people so that when we pass on, there is a legacy of how to do things differently. So the Madawara Council is, as I said, elders who self-nominate to be on the council. It's bottom-up, not top-down, and we're here to guide the development projects that are happening on country, but also to dream about what the new economies could be, should be, must be.
And one thing directly related to that, back in 2017, the Whanganui River in New Zealand was granted the same legal rights as a human being. In 2016, you argued for the same rights for the Marawara in Australia. What happened?
Well, a lot of the work we do is also not just looking at legal pluralism, which is a very important point, but when I heard that story about the Whanganui, the Whanganui being granted personhood, I was so excited and I said to the other elders, oh, do you realise a river in New Zealand has got personhood? And what about if we were to be on a similar journey where the Marawara was also to be granted personhood? And that it was really strange because they looked at me and they said, in regards to the river, e not a human being. The river is not a human being. It is an ancestral being. And so from that perspective, I sort of took a step back and realized that the work that we had to do in terms of framing how special and globally unique our river is as a living ancestral being, it was to change the frame and start to advocate towards ancestral beings, because I know right around the world, Indigenous people do have ancestral beings, mountains, rivers, sacred trees, sacred places that are ancestral to us in terms of working with us, guiding us, and we're in a deep relationship with it. So the Marawara is that living ancestral serpent being. When I introduce myself, I go, Ngāiu I Marawara Manan. I am a woman who belongs to the Marawara. So the river is really there to guide us, create our identity. It has given us our first law. It has given us a code of conduct, a moral obligation, a set of, in a way we could call them rules, of how to care for this river from now till the beginning of time to the future.
Thank you for that. And we are going to get into first law here in a little bit more deeply. But first, you recently co-authored a scientific paper titled Ancient Wisdom, Dreaming a Climate Chance. One of the co-authors is the Marawara. To most non-Indigenous people, co-authoring a scientific paper with a river might be a little bit unfamiliar. Would you please share just a little bit about the significance of this co-authoring?
Yeah, well, the Marawara is actually the living being that gives me the authority to have a voice and to speak on behalf of the river because we're in total engagement with it. So the Marawara River of Life is first author on many of our publications, and it's been a very, very interesting journey in terms of getting this recognised by scientific journals and other peer-reviewed articles that the river, Marawara River of Life, is the ancestor. It's the one that has given us our wisdom, created our identity. It is watching what the humans are doing. And so this is a way of giving the river a direct voice through the people, through publications such as this, films that we make. So I think it's the first ever in the world that I wrote an abstract in my Indigenous language, and that was a first. And so one of the things that we're saying is that we've got to be brave as Indigenous people. We must speak back to colonialism. And so this was a way of giving voice to the Marawara, and it has been accepted in many of our publications. So from that, we kind of think that we need novel ways to bring the people with us. And so even just citing the river as the author and the giver of all our knowledge and wisdom and practice, it really places the frame that we are respectful because our world is all about all of these things, about relationship, about respect, about reciprocity, but also about responsibility. So all of these things come into play, these values, and so therefore the river is out there being published across the globe as Marawara River of Life.
Oh, that's perfect. And the last line from the introduction of this paper reads, "What can ancient wisdom, traditional knowledge from the oldest living human culture on Mother Earth share with humanity?" And to me, it just seems strikingly obvious that this is the single most important question for all of us on the planet today. And this really gets down to the very root of this podcast and how it came into being. And one of the guiding questions that I've been asking folks is, how did we get here to this point? How did so-called modern human beings bring us to this point? And the fact that you have to even pose the aforementioned question in your paper really practically, at least to me, begs the question of how did we get here?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And sometimes I go back to the beginning of Western thought and Western thinking, particularly around the Bible, like in terms of creation stories, because what we share is creation stories as well. But when I go back to the creation story of Christianity and we hear about the Garden of Eden and how when people did the wrong thing, they were banished from that Garden of Eden. So as Indigenous people across the world, we have not walked away from the Garden of Eden. We have not walked away from nature. We see ourselves coexisting with nature and nature being very, very much a part of who we are as human being. So from this perspective, this is what we're saying is that, you know, it's a very important time and we really need to look at how did we get to this point is exactly the question. So first of all, it's looking at those stories of Christianity and bringing them together and saying that really what I'm seeing is people of multiple faith coming together and standing in unity because we are up against very, very big odds. What we've done is we've commodified nature. We've put a dollar value on it. So that's why we've got this clash of values. And so what we're saying as Indigenous people is that we are part of nature. We are really at the forefront of guiding it, looking after it, caring for it. And in the time there's been, you know, this change of thinking in terms of the dominance of Western cultures, because this is not just a recent phenomena for people of the planet. When I travel the world and I go to places, you know, in Europe, France, and I go way, way, way out into remote areas and I find those people who are still connected with the land, with their values, with their ethics, with their virtues, they care about country. And so there are stories that have come from the beginning of time. I mean, Brothers Grimm and, you know, some of the old ancient stories of Western thinking are exactly the same ideas and ideals in terms of how the land is part of us. And unless we can look after the land, we can't coexist with it. So it's all about balance. It's all about peace. It's all about harmony. And in the last couple of hundred years, what we've seen is a dominance of what my old people say, greed's got them beat. What we see is a new way that people are being governed around the world because really at the end of the day, it's all about leadership. It's all about governance. It's about how do we care for our people collectively, Indigenous and not. And so what we're seeing is that there's a real clash of values that has occurred in the last 200 years, 150 in my people's lifetime, where colonialism and globalization have really come in as a very, very toxic element where money has been given higher value as opposed to people and place. So it's really looking at this and thinking, where have we come as human beings to this place? And what I'm saying is that my people lived and coexisted with this land without money. Wonderful forms of capital that held together peace, harmony, and balance. Social capital, cultural capital, human capital. And this is even what Eleanor Ostrom was writing about, how we are there to care for the commons, for the common good of humanity and all of us. And so what I'm saying is that this seems to be a dominance of globalization, neoliberalism, where money has become the new god and not faith-based nurturing and caring for each other and for nature. So I think what's happening and what I can see across the world is a real global dominance of how our systems of living and sharing and caring for each other have become dominated by those who have now wealth, and with wealth they have absolute power, and we're seeing that infiltrate at all the different levels, at the multinational and global level where we know that there are about six different families that rule the world with extreme wealth, and then how does that filter down and impact on nation states and government and governance and leadership in our own nation states. So this is what I'm seeing, this great turmoil where we've moved away from nature, we've commodified it, we put a dollar value on it, and we start to prize money rather than people and the human spirit.
And this is the perfect point now to get deeper into talking about values, which you just mentioned as well. Part of the abstract from this paper that you co-authored says, quote, coexistence is the embodiment of life itself. This balance and harmony with our living cultural landscapes grounds the philosophical framework of values, ethics, virtues, and belief the law is in the land, not in man. Would you please talk a bit more about this concept?
Yeah, no, it's a very important concept. And for us here in Australia, and particularly in the region that I live, when we are born, we are given a judinj or a totem, and we are bonded to that totem for life. And that totem can be a bird, can be an animal, can be a tree, can be a mountain, but we form that relationship and we get to know as much as we can through that lifelong relationship with that totem. And so that totem teaches us how to create an ethics of care, how to look at the world in terms of seeing nature and human beings coexisting in a world that can and is beautiful, around values, around ethics, around these virtues. So a totem teaches us an ethics of care. It teaches us about values. It teaches us about virtues. So for me, my totem is the blue-tongued lizard. In my language, we call it a ngalyak. So I'm bonded to that ngalyak, that totem for life. And that totem actually teaches me how to be a good and decent human being, how to care about something beyond yourself. So it takes me to the philosophy that we have, is that we live in a world where we coexist with our totems, and that we build a world around values and ethics and virtues. And through those values and ethics, we bind ourselves through a moral obligation, a moral contract, to protect all of the things that are with us, because we live in a world that is reliant on that symbiotic relationship between nature and people. We learn that even the wind can have a name, that it can bring a story, that trees that are standing there as sentinel beings have watched how we've walked the landscape and managed the landscape, that a creature like a blue-tongued lizard can teach me to have empathy and care and think about other creatures, not in isolation of humans dominating species, but humans living in coexistence with species. So those laws that we talked about, you know, in terms of values, ethics, virtues, it teaches us how to see and be in the world a different way, how to feel the land, how to hear the land, how to hear what species are saying to us as well, that they can bring messages, we can communicate with them. And this is something that Indigenous people have been doing from the beginning of time. And this is something that we are now teaching fellow human beings, how to feel the consciousness of the place that they're in, how to build a relationship, how to have respect, how to think about reciprocity so that this is a two-way process of engagement, how to think about, but not only think about it, but have a responsibility to care and love and protect it, and to think about multi-species justice as well as human justice.
This then really brings us into, again, I'm not sure if it's completely related to the values concept or ethics or virtues, but or even just it's such a different epistemology from that of industrialized Western so-called modern human, the disconnect from the planet, which you talked about a little bit earlier. And I think some of that disconnect is the reason for there's so much despair around what's happening on Earth today, from all the different crises, the climate crisis, the loss of biodiversity, extinctions, grotesque wealth disparities. It's a very, very long list. And in addition to that, I've seen people in so much despair that they even get to a point where they say, well, the Earth will be better off without us anyway if we end up managing to kill ourselves off with all these crises. And contrasted to this, your paper also says we can dream together so we can better understand how we as human beings can once again start to live in harmony with each other and with our non-human families. We need to enjoy and defend our amazing planet, Mother Earth, and life itself from climate chaos and destruction. Otherwise, Mother Earth will be lonely without the vibrations of human beings.
It is a real topic, isn't it? And when I was writing this paper, in my mind, I was hearing other colleagues say to me and talk to me about the Extinction Rebellion people, and in that this was actually a phrase that had come from them in terms of, okay, if we are so stupid as human beings and we befall our own demise, Mother Earth will right-size herself. And that's what brought me to that point in saying that, yes, Mother Earth will right-size herself. She has the power to regenerate and to heal herself, particularly if the humans are not there. And then I realized that my connection to country is to have the vibrations on the earth and to connect and to feel the earth and to speak to the earth and hear the vibrations from the earth. And so I thought very, very quickly that what we must do is come together and stop discounting the ancient wisdom of Indigenous people, of First Nations people across the globe, because we have lived with the Anthropocene in the past, particularly in my country, and we have shaped that. So we were living always in a symbiotic relationship. So what we're saying is that Western thinking, Western thought, top-down leadership and governance, which has become toxic, must have a pause, must listen to this ancient wisdom, because this is the ancient wisdom that can teach us how to see and be in the world a different way. It is totally a clash of values. As I said earlier, Eleanor Ostrom was writing about this, how Indigenous people hold the solutions for planetary well-being around the commons, how we can work together for our greater common good. I mean, what we've been doing for the last 200 years has just been extraction and destruction of the earth, changing and destabilizing the energy systems that hold life, that give life. And we're in a situation now where unless we can turn back within the next, I'm not sure when, we are going to befall our own demise. So it's really about waking up what we call waking up the snake, waking up the consciousness of the people to look around them and wake up. It's so, so difficult because part of this story is how we are dumbed down by media, how we are in a situation where each and every one of us, particularly in my country, Australia, families are struggling, social systems are imploding, schools, hospitals, doctors are walking away from medical practice because they can't afford to continue to service the work they're doing amongst the growing pressure of what it's costing to live. So it's a really interesting time where we're saying that we must have a pause. We must listen to the wisdom of Indigenous people, that we can still continue to have a good and powerful and beautiful life, but it cannot be in the destructive elements of continuing to destroy these energy systems, because once we continue to extract the final energy systems, the earth will implode and will need to right size. So what we're saying as Indigenous people, not just in my country, but around the world where we've held on to these last bastions of biodiversity, we're saying this is the lifeblood of the planet. These last places that we have protected and held on to under much pressure, strife, continual invasion and unjust development, we really need to look at how do we change the value and realize that it is nature that sustains our well-being, nature that gives us the oxygen, nature that creates the rivers of life, nature that creates all of those things in abundance that we need to sustain ourselves as human beings on this planet. So what we're saying is that we do hold solutions for how to right size the planet. We are dreaming together with non-Indigenous people where I work, showing that we can build what I call the forever industries around bioprospecting, around global geoparks, around biosphere reserves, about creating walking trails to walk people along our ancient river to show the multiple values of this sense of place and purpose and why it is so special to be a human being. And so these values, these ethics, these ways that we see and be in the world, we want to share them. And it's interesting because non-Indigenous people are also hungry for this interaction, to learn this wisdom, to walk the country, to feel the country, to see the country a different way. I had just put together a paper looking at dreaming as a research methodology, and it was difficult for the assessors to understand that concept. So we've now changed the frame of it, my daughter and I. We've changed the frame to go, this methodology is how to feel and hear the lands, how to hear and feel country, how to hear and feel rivers, how to hear and feel these ancient landscapes. So we kind of feel we're in a moment in time where we're working very, very hard with non-Indigenous people, scientists, industry, different stakeholders to say, can we have a pause? Can we have a total reset? Can we have a look at our duty of care to Mother Earth in regards to the fugitive emissions that we continue to generate? I mean, I cannot believe our country, Australia, is still opening up new coal mines, that they're ready to frack our river system and possibly create the largest man-made destruction on the planet. So our story is, how can we show the economics of well-being as opposed to the economics of destruction? And so the politics of economics is so out there in the world, and we need a different way to tell the story. And that's why I'm saying we need this ancient wisdom. We need to tell the story a different way. We seem to be so testosterone out on science that people are not listening. They can't listen because they're struggling to just live day to day, Indigenous and non. And so we need to find different ways to dream, different ways to tell the story, through song, through dance, through ceremony, through walking the country and feeling the country, through walking trails and those sorts of what we call, as I said, the forever industries.
And speaking with you, Anne, I can just feel this opening of the aperture of what I can see when I look out at the world, because the crisis perspective is, and this is a question, but I presume, especially listening to you describe these things, that the crisis perspective is very Western. It's very industrialized compared to the perspective that you're talking about. And I wonder if a reason for this is, at least in part, because of your concept of time. And you just mentioned dreaming several times. And your recent paper also discusses, and I'm going to quote from it, the Indigenous concept of Bukirara, a Northwest Australian Indigenous philosophy, spirituality, and practice. Bukirara connects and contextualizes the temporal fusion of the past, present, and future in our reality known as the dreaming. Is it possible for you to unpack this concept a little bit further for us?
Yeah, no, Bukirara is a very big word. It's a very special word, and it is exactly as you've said. It's when we look at the past, how do we learn from the past? What are the stories that we've been told, not just in terms of Indigenous wisdom, but also, you know, Western thinking, Western thought? But the other thing to understand is that we have high culture, people who've come from India, from, you know, Arabia, who were, you know, out there doing amazing things beyond this last 200 years of globalization and neoliberalism. They had dreaming, they had ceremony, they had song, they had dance. They've got this idea of how do we bring that. So what is the ancient wisdom from these peak civilizations who've also been there, but now we've been dominated in the last 200 years about Western thinking? And this Western thinking is very much around the ideology of Paulo Freire, a South American educator, who really unpacked what is colonialism? What is it? How has it changed the world in the last 200 years? And when you look at the characteristics of colonialism, what we're talking about is conflict. About creating conflict, about creating, you know, manipulation, divide and rule, not thinking that we're living in a pluriverse. So this anti-dialogic, don't talk, just do. Don't go in with informed consent, talk to the people about how unjust development could occur. Just go in and bully your way through and continue to dominate the way unjust development happens on our tribal lands and on our living systems. So that's really important. So how do we learn from the past? How do we look around the world and see this pluriverse of ideas that come from ancient cultures, not just Indigenous, but the ancient wisdom of those people who lived in Arabia, in India, in China? And so this thinking is there. So that's what looking at the past means. How do we look at the past? How do we learn from that? How do we understand that we cannot keep doing what we're doing to Mother Earth and to Indigenous people and to nature and think that we're all going to be fine? And then you come from the past into the present. So we take that thinking about the past, we look at it in the present. And this is one of the things I'm saying. We are dealing with complexity. And so we need collective wisdom. We need the wisdom of Western science with Indigenous science and knowledges. We need to bring them together and see how can we create a future together? How can we create a future together right now? So that's what we talk about. We are in this moment in time where we must look at the past, dream the future for what we want, but act in the now. And we have to do that as a collective. So we're not saying that Indigenous wisdom or Indigenous knowledge is the only way. We're saying that it's part of the planetary solution in dealing with the complexity of what climate change is now upon us, turning into climate chaos, unless we can sit together, realize that we live in a pluriverse, not a universe, where we need all of these different forms of thinking to come up with the solutions that can create a future for young children not born yet.
I wonder how much of what you just discussed is I'm sure there's always overlap. The question is how much, and please correct my pronunciation of this word, but the concept of Wurlungari law?
Yeah, this is very, very important. Wurlungari law. Wurlungari law is the first law, law of the land, law of the river. And so through Wurlungari law, along the Fitzroy River, the Muddawara, 733 kilometres of it, that was the law that united all people from the bottom of the catchment to the top, from the top to the bottom, as well as out into the periphery of the desert. So Wurlungari law was framed around one society. So all of us are seen as one society bound together under first law, Wurlungari law. So the law was really a way, a song, a story of how to think about the river as such an amazing system. So in the song, it says, come in, everybody, come in, come in. Let the river replenish your soul, your spirit. And then when you are full and re-nurtured, go back to where you came from and tell your people why the river is so important, why it needs to be here as the lifeblood of our people in this region, not just for Indigenous people, but for all. So that's what's really, really important about the song. In regards to Wurlungari law, it is exactly about creating those values, those ethics, those virtues, a code of conduct to protect this river under a moral code of conduct. So it's very, very important. What Wurlungari law does through these values, these ethics, these virtues of showing that the commons is there for our common good and that we must all be protecting it for the betterment of life for everything around us. One of the things that's different about first law is that these values, these creation stories teach us how to self-regulate, how we agree to be bonded in a civil way to create civil society. So it's a way of bringing people together, sharing values, virtues, but most importantly, we have a bond to each other, a bond to the land, a bond to nature that teaches us how to self-regulate our behavior, which is totally the opposite to Western law. Western law is about creating a law that is going to create regulations that will then regulate human behavior. And so what we see is the two different clashes of law systems. One, where we agree to bond together and come up under a code of conduct of this is the way that we will agree to live with each other and we will self-regulate our behavior for the greater good of all, as opposed to Western law, which really is about creating a law to regulate behavior, both human and industrial, and then work out how is it going to then tell you what to do, and if you don't do it, punish you. So this is a really difference in terms of how we see first law, law of the land, and Western law, which is, in my country, crown law. So how do we bring them together? And what we've got is two totally opposite views of what law means and how people are either self-regulating or being regulated under the Western system. And what we're now seeing in my country is that these laws are failing. Environmental laws, those types of things are failing how to protect the environment. Last year in Australia, there were a group of young people that took our federal government, our Commonwealth government, to court, saying that the federal minister for the environment had a duty of care to ensure that future generations would be able to inherit a world that was beautiful and improving and creating no foreseeable harm upon them. They lost that case, and our government found that the Minister for the Environment does not have a fiduciary duty to protect the well-being of young people in this country. So that's a law that has failed. Environmental laws, that when we have huge projects that come to our country that want to do things, we cannot talk about the whole of mine life or the whole of development. We can only talk about, oh, this company just wants to do a dig so it can get core samples. And yet the companies are able to advertise nationally and globally of how big their development's going to be. So there's a real clash, as I said, of values and virtues in these two laws. And it is really almost impossible to compare both of them. So, you know, some people say to me, well, how do you see a fusion of first law with legal pluralism? And what I'm saying is that first law is a philosophical stance to show what are the ways that we can bring this philosophy, this worldview into looking at how do we develop crown law, law from government, law from sovereignty that has come upon us from another nation state. How do we do that in a way that is going to ensure that we can look at all of these things? Now, one of the things I talked about Wallangari law, which is the law for the river. But where I live, as I said, there are about 9 different nations that live in the Kimberley. So one of the other laws that we had from the beginning of time was called Wunan law. And that was a regional governance model. And that was about reciprocity, about trade, about sharing ceremony. So we have always seen ourselves from a total watershed perspective. Even though we have our law for our river, other places have laws for the desert, for the hill country, for the ranges. But there was also a law called the Wunan law, which we still recognize today. And that was to look at the collective well-being within regions. So this is some of the thinking that I'm trying to bring into Western thinking, Western practice, different ways to look at this in terms of saying that what we need to be thinking about is how do we create ways that we can live together in a region and that all of us, Indigenous and not, come together in a regional, bioregional framework to look at, okay, how do we make assessments and judgment on cumulative impacts of development so that Indigenous and non-Indigenous people can look at this and go, okay, where's all the evidence? Can we make informed decisions about what we're going to do? Where does procedural justice come into this? Where does distributive justice come into this? And so how do we work together for the betterment of the region and the people in the region determine what's in and what's out? And so it's very, very interesting at this point in time because, as I said, we've created what I write about, these unlawful, awful laws that are really having these very big impacts on the environment, on people, but also fast-tracking unjust, invasive colonial development that impacts on all of us. Because as I say, one of the big issues is that non-Indigenous people are also unaware of what the government's intentions are for these unjust development projects. So we need to find a way to really go back to the old laws and think about how do we govern for the greater good of all of us from regional perspectives. And what's really interesting in our nation state is that we do have a policy until 2030 called the Bioregional Framework, where we could do this if there was the political goodwill to do this. But at the moment in our nation state, and particularly in my state, what we're doing is dumbing down democracy and really, as I said earlier, making top-down, toxic, centralized governance decisions where people who are 2,000 kilometers away are the ones who determine what happens in regards to development projects in the region. They are dumbing down the local governance situation from a Western perspective. So everything is now centralized in the city. And so even the representation that normally came from the people last year was removed. And that's for all of us, Indigenous and non. So what we're seeing is we need to ask the question, what is democracy? How do we all have a voice? How do we sit around the table as decent and good human beings, look at all of the evidence and say what projects are on the table, what projects are off, and what is the cumulative impact? What's the cost burden? What's the cost benefit? Is this project going to be good for the region? How is it going to impact on water, the landscape, nature, and the environment, particularly in terms of climate change? And should we be allowing that project to proceed? So it's all of those things that I've talked about coming into that and saying that this way of governing really makes sense. We need to be brave and push the boundaries and say that, you know, this is part of Bugaragara, that one of the things that we are challenged as Indigenous people is that we do what we can do because we see time not in a linear way but in a circle of time. So I as a human being can only do what I do on the belief that the world, our planet, will be sustainable and that in a moment in time, maybe not in my lifetime, but hopefully in my grandson's time, we will start to look at listening to the voices of Indigenous people, bringing in collective wisdom of all of us in the regions to be able to look after the commons for our greater common good.
Thank you. And you've also written right along much of what you just shared. You wrote, state and federal governments continue to heavily invest into invasive lawful development, diminish funding and policy investment into Indigenous enterprise and communities maintains the perception that governments in Australia have a lower value on Australian citizens than they have for the value of multinational corporations. And then you went on to add, we know how to live. Our philosophy and practices have been developed over countless generations, and we invite all to participate in these life ways. We happily share our life ways and wisdom through stories. And to me, when I read that, it felt like an antidote. It was really the antithesis of so-called modern governments essentially being run by corporate power at this point, and the modus operandi of most of those corporations. So your open invitation to everyone and anyone to participate, really a total sharing of these life ways, is such a contrast. That's why it really struck me. It's a sort of an antidote to what we're seeing happening.
It is an antidote to what's happening, but this is the thing is my people also say that we hear with our eyes and we see with our ears. So it's a total different philosophical way to be in the world. But what we're trying to do is show that Indigenous people across the planet, we should not be crucified for standing up to protect the land, because we are protecting it not just for Indigenous people, but for our non-human family, but also for our fellow citizens. And so what we're saying is that we need to wake up, as I said, wake up the snake, wake up the consciousness, be brave. I mean, people like me are at the front line of these unjust developments, and we are exposed to extreme violence, even from our own leaders who have now taken on neoliberal values. And what we're saying is that we have to be brave. I said earlier that I have a grandson now. So I don't want to be like David Suzuki, that when I'm bending down to talk to my grandson that I'm going to be weeping. I want to see and believe that there is a future for my grandson, for other people's children, for children not born yet. One of the greatest ingredients I say is that we have to build a coalition of hope. And that coalition of hope really needs to be started not now, but yesterday. We need to bring people together and say that we want to dream together. We want a future for your children. What I tell fellow Australians is that this is now your country. Your DNA is embedded in this cultural landscape. You should grow an ethics of care and love for this place because it is also now your home. So how do we bring the people with them? How do we create narratives that are a collective story where there's meaning that we all have a role to play, you know what I mean? So it's not about alienating anybody. It's about bringing people together, showing that we do have new economies that are sustainable, that are the forever industries, that can be here for generations to come. And these things are around the world. Maybe we need these last bastions of biodiversity that Indigenous people are holding on to as the last umbilical cord, the last lifeline for well-being and sustaining the planet. Maybe what we need to do is realize that this is where truth lies, not in the stories that our governments who are beholden to the multinationals are telling us. So it's quite a difficult time in my country because one of the things is many of the social fabric of our societies is imploding because we continue to invest in multinational companies that are destroying the lifeblood, the energy systems of our planet. I just saw the other day that we are spending $22,000 a minute in oil and gas, and yet how much of that wealth is coming back to Indigenous people whose lands are creating this wealth? How much is coming back to our people? Very, very little. How much is coming back to fellow Australians to sustain our hospitals, to our schools, all of these social products that we need so that we can continue to have peace and harmony and well-being for all our citizens, not just for Indigenous people? So we really need to find a way to bring people together. And as I said, it's through different ways of talking. I mean, I'm doing the keynote for the International IUCN in Canberra in a couple of weeks. They want to know, how does this story wrap around the biodiversity framework? And I'm saying everything has got to work together. Without Indigenous people, we are the first everything in this country. The first scientists, the first anthropologists, archaeologists, we practiced this. So stop othering us. See ourselves as part of you and part of planetary well-being. Listen to this ancient wisdom that we have from the beginning of time right around the world. I mean, several years ago, 2010, I was in Redstone, Oklahoma, and we made the Redstone Statement, where people came together and said that was over nearly, well, quite a few years ago. But we seem to be ignoring the most pertinent bit of knowledge and practice that can right-size the planet. And if we don't listen to this wisdom, Earth will meet its own demise, but it will right-size itself with or without human beings. But I have a dream, as many Indigenous people do around the world, that we will, as Indigenous people, we will have people who will remain with Mother Earth and will continue to right-size and sing and dance and be part of the future. But that dreaming is now, and we have much work to do. And so together, Indigenous and not, we must walk together, because we are all human beings and we all need to be brave, and we all need to realise that this planet has been monopolised by very few predatory elite families that control the global economics. In my country, this story remains the same. When Britain lost the Americas, they knew this country was here. So when they came, you know, they brought people that they had enslaved from their own community. But multinational companies have always been in charge. And that's why I said $22,000 a minute. That is just unbelievable that we are continuing to create new coal mines despite what the science is telling us. And we must get our nation state to realize we are all on one planet, Mother Earth, and that we all must have this moral obligation to right size the planet if we are to have a future as human beings.
And people are starting to listen, even in some very unlikely institutions. You wrote to Pope Francis. What you wrote was published by the Vatican in 2016. What did you write to him?
I wrote to him a beautiful poem I wrote and basically thanked him for his leadership in terms of Laudato Si, to say that Indigenous people around the world are listening, that we carry many disciplines, and I'm standing as a scientist. And what we were saying is that we need, as I said earlier, we need collective wisdom to be able to right-size the planet. So in terms of the words for the Pope, it was just really to thank him for Laudato Si and for seeing that it is us Indigenous people who have contributed the least amount to the destruction of the planet, yet this harm in terms of cultural genocide and ecocide is happening on our doorsteps today. And we need a way to have this mechanism to speak back to colonialism and globalization. And so it was very, very interesting. I was talking also to some of the scientists that work in the Vatican, and they said, yeah, it's very difficult to understand why we have not made the transition, because we have a gift from the Creator and it is free and it is called the sun. So we have energy systems that can sustain us if we are willing to invest and look at how do we do this, not in terms of green cladding, but how do we look at what the true impacts of these development projects can be, could be, should be, and how do we work together in terms of bringing all of this wisdom together and sitting around and valuing, not discounting or undermining what we're saying. How do we bring that to the table? How do we have an opportunity to privilege our voice? So through that process, I was able to privilege my voice. As I said, I wear many hats, not just as a scientist, but a filmmaker and a poet and storyteller. So, you know, poems are a great way of pulling all this together, sharing telling stories, making films, but really profiling that we have not walked away from the Garden of Eden as Indigenous people across the globe. These last bastions of biodiversity are so precious. Their value should really be seen in terms of multiple worth and how do we bring that together to sustain and not compete with the unjust economic development, but show that we can bring about the new economies, the forever industries, and that we can right-size the planet. But our voices need to be valued, they need to be privileged, and they need to be out there. And really, people need to slow down and listen to the meaning of the stories that we are telling, because what we're saying is that we care about our fellow brothers and sisters, Indigenous and not, and we want to continue to dance, to sing, to celebrate on the earth, for the earth to feel our vibrations as we move and dance ceremony and talk with it. And what we're saying is that this is the story that many non-Indigenous people are waking up to. As I caught a plane the other day to go to Perth to the city to have a conversation with our politicians, somebody was rushing and I said, oh, where have you come from? And she said, oh, I've just come from the top of the hill country and I'm now catching the plane back to Sweden. I said, oh, thank you for visiting us. And she said, this is my 10th visit. So people are coming here. They are feeling the earth. They are traveling around. They are communicating with Indigenous people. They are getting to understand what it means to be human, how to live in coexistence with nature, how not to continually destroy this beauty that the Creator has made for all of us in whatever form. And so not only are scientists rising, but people of multi-faith are uniting. And the Vatican has been a real catalyst for bringing about this unity among the diversity of multi-faith people. And we are standing and celebrating not only our faith, but the power of the human spirit to give voice to people like me and other leaders who are standing to say, we want to be able to continue to dance upon the Mother Earth. We don't want her to be lonely. We want to continue to be a part of her. And we can all share in that and celebrate and show that it can't be business as usual. We do need a total reset.
And this has been medicine listening to you, and we're starting to come towards the end of our time. I want to read one more thing that you wrote and ask you to talk a little bit more about it, if you will. You wrote, "Together as a region, a nation, and globally, we can dream a collective dream to include the complementary principles of first law back to the we and not the me. If not, we will have caused our own demise." To me, that's a message of both hope, but also a warning.
It is a story of hope and it is a warning. And what we're saying, as I said, as part of being brave, we have a duty of care to speak to our fellow humans and to share with them in terms of saying what can be, how to dream the possibility of new futures, of new future economies, of ways that we can sit and share and talk together and show that just development is possible, but it cannot continue with colonialism and invasive unjust development, because these are very big public interest matters and we all need to be at the table together so that we understand, as I said earlier, distributive and procedural justice so that Mother Earth and humanity can have a climate chance.
And thank you for an extraordinary conversation. And I really, really appreciate you taking some time out of your very busy schedule. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity to allow me to privilege my voice. It is a privilege and an honor to be able to have access to these types of global podcasts that go across the planet, because this is the same message, whether it's from Turtle Island, whether it's from the Kimberley, or whether it's from Brazil. So thank you very much for allowing me to share these stories. And I really believe that we can dream together and give Mother Earth a chance to survive and we can dance upon her girth. Thank you very much. Kali o mabu.
Slip right through. Whoa, 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 whoa. It's your heart and hope to die. Look that monster in the eye.
This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Dar Jamail, Melody Travers Allison, Asher Miller, and Rob Dietz. theme music is Hold That Spirit by Ray Zaragoza. And you can learn more about this podcast, along with other information on The Great Unraveling, at resilience.org. The song you are hearing is Yunguruku by Anne's son, Mark Cole Smith, from his album, Kalaji. Thanks for listening to Holding the Fire, Indigenous Voices on the Great Unraveling. Please tune in next week when I'll be speaking with Aslak Helmand, the president of the Sami Council.